Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies and blueprints. I tell stories. I share some of those big epic fails I've made along the way. And I interview experts, which is what I did today. I'm super excited about this episode. It really taps into that notion of curiosity and wonder, and I can't wait to tell you all about this interview. I got the chance to interview Dr. Sarah McAnulty. She is a squid biologist and a science communicator. She received her PhD in molecular and cell biology, working on Hawaiian bobtail squid symbiosis in 2019. She is currently the executive director of Skype a Scientist. It's a nonprofit that connects over 10,000 classrooms to scientists every single year. Dr. McAnulty is a prolific science communicator with an active presence on Twitter and Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, and she's been featured in Nature, Forbes, NPR Shortwave, along with many others. I'm so excited to have her here and to share with you the interview that I got a chance to do. So without further ado, here we go. Here's Dr. Sarah McAnulty. All right, we have here Dr. Sarah McAnulty, and she has founded this group, Skype a Scientist. And I would love to just start out by having you share kind of the backstory of how you founded this organization and what you all do.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. So I founded Skype a Scientist back in 2017. This was right after the Trump election. I was on Twitter and talking to my fellow scientists, and there was just like a lot of anxiety around all the changes that were happening in the country. And I wanted to funnel all of that energy towards something positive. And so science communication and connecting with people who aren't scientists about science has been really important to me for a long time. And I wanted to make it easier for scientists to do the same thing. And so I founded Skype a Scientist. And what we do is match up scientists with classrooms all around the world to talk about science. We serve about 10 to 11,000 groups a year. And the program is totally free for teachers to sign up to.
So age group wise, what are typically the classroom grades that sign up most frequently? I'm just curious in terms of how that has worked.
Yeah, it's a pretty even spread from K through 12. I think we sometimes get slightly less high school just because I think teachers are, and you all know this, are pretty cramped for time during those years. Your curricula are tight. So we're a little more enriched for elementary, but any age group we can handle. We ask our scientists what age groups they're super comfortable working with. So you get matched with a scientist who is comfortable working with whatever age group you have.
So when it comes to the conversations, when they're, you know, Skyping the scientist, what are the typical conversations like? Like, could you walk me through a little bit what one might look like, say, in a middle school science classroom?
Absolutely. So we ask our scientists to give the teacher and the students a little something to work with, just so that they know what the scientist knows a lot about. I think there's a pretty common misconception that scientists know a lot about everything, and we really tend to know a lot about one specific thing. So, you know, I am a marine biologist, but I'm really a squid biologist. So if you ask me about squid, I'm probably going to know the answer. But if you ask me a question about dolphins, I might know the answer. But honestly, I probably know about the same as any other person walking down the street about dolphins, maybe a little bit more. And so we like to prepare everybody for what we really know about, and remind you that we're human and only have so much space in our brain anyway for all this stuff. So we like to give you a sense of who we are, what we do, what we know. And then typically there's a little bit of introduction from the scientist, maybe 5, maximum 10 minutes of us introducing what we do and what our lives are like. And from there, it's mostly Q&A. So your class, your audience, is really what determines where the conversation will go. I know I've heard a lot of feedback from scientists that a lot of the high school classrooms, it ends up talking a lot about what is college? How do you get into college? How is it different from high school for maybe students who don't have any family members who went to college? For middle school, it might be more like, you know, what's the favorite animal you've ever worked with? Where's the farthest you've ever gone to study science and that kind of thing? It can be, you know, more about the subject matter itself. It really is widely, we can make it work for whatever your needs are.
One of the things I think about is there are a lot of cultural misperceptions about scientists and stereotypes and all of these different things. What do you see as, what are some of the stereotypes that get broken as students start talking with real scientists?
I think that this is one of the most important parts of our program. I think, first of all, there are a lot of misconceptions about science. First of all, that, like I've already mentioned today, that we know everything. We don't. We know a lot about a little thing. So we're not these ultra geniuses. We're just people who really, really like and have dedicated a lot of time to one thing that we're really, really into. You also see in our program that we're not all like old, white, crazy haired dudes. That is a misconception that I do think is getting better over the years, but it's still definitely prevalent in some places. And so people may be surprised to see how young a lot of our scientists are. A lot of our volunteers are in graduate school, so they're in their 20s. That is sometimes surprising. And we also will match a classroom with that has over half of their students from a given historically excluded group in STEM with a scientist from that same group if we have that person available. And so it can, we really value representation at Skype a Scientist. We try to make sure that we give you a scientist that not only is the right subject match, but also is a great match for representation and showing your students that people like them are in science right now actively. And so yeah, that's super, super important to us.
Do you find, we'll get back to representation in just a second, but do you find that students are ever surprised at how, for lack of a better term, normal scientists are? Like, I feel like as a child, I had this perception of a scientist, and then I met scientists and realized like, oh, they listen to the same music we listen to or watch the same TV shows. Or, you know, do you see any of students getting surprised when scientists know the same pop culture or any of that kind of stuff?
For sure. I mean, the things that surprise me, that surprise people who I talk to, what they're surprised by sometimes surprises me. Like, for example, I was, this was a couple years ago, I was up working in Connecticut visiting this after-school program, and I was just wearing like my standard like athleisure gear that day. I was wearing leggings. I was going to go to the gym after this, this talk. And this little girl, she was like maybe 7 years old, and she was like, "Scientists wear leggings?" And I was like, well, yeah, like we're just like anybody else. And, you know, like they'll be surprised to see that you have a dog in the house. Like, oh, you're a scientist with a dog? It's like, yeah, sure. Of course we are. We're just people. And so, yeah, the things that surprise folks is not surprising to me anymore. But at the beginning, I was like, wow, we have a lot of work to do in just like humanizing our profession.
Yeah. As you think about the representation piece, you know, I think about students of color, I think about women, gender minorities, members of the LGBT plus population. What do you see as the biggest benefit of having someone from any of those members of the community, or sometimes layers, right, with intersectionality, engaging with students?
I mean, I think it's incredibly valuable. So we try to highlight like a wide variety of identities in our live stream program. And we also, I mean, science is comprised of a lot of different people from all different backgrounds. It's not like a monoculture at all. And so we really want to show the true diversity that exists in science by highlighting a lot of different people. I know when I was growing up, I really didn't know any scientists. And then I went to college. I met scientists, of course, there. But even, you know, this was back in 2007, there were no women in the marine biology department. None, not one. And so it was not until like late in my sophomore year of college that I met a scientist who was a woman. And I'm like a white woman. And that's how long it took for me to find representation. I want that to be better for everybody, not just for white women. I want it to be better for everybody. It just shouldn't take that long to encounter a scientist that looks like you. There are a lot of studies showing how important representation is for people seeing themselves in these careers. And I want to make sure that we're exposing people to scientists that they can relate to as early as we possibly can.
You know, one of the things that I'm struck by in hearing this is, I'm now at the college level, but I used to teach in a middle school, and our student population was largely Latino, Latina. Many of them were first generation college students. And one of the challenges that we kept seeing in the sciences in particular was that when they went to college, even if they were doing well, when things got really challenging, there was this tendency when you were surrounded by people that were largely white in a lot of these universities, professors that were mostly white men, and I'm not being critical of white men here, just the reality of this situation.
That was, yeah.
And they began to hit challenges, there was a tendency to switch majors.
Right.
And it was really hard because it's challenging for everybody. You know, like, I don't think that they always knew that they weren't alone and that these courses get really hard for everyone.
Right.
So I'm curious, what would you say to that student who is going into a university and maybe the department doesn't look like them? And they are going to get challenges. What advice would you have for that student?
That's a really good question. I think my first piece of advice would be find your community and make sure that you're never alone. Even if you can't find someone who looks like you, who came from an area that you came from, like connect with people who are going to be honest about what they're going through too, and find a support system the best you can. Because I think that it's a super, super common thing for students of color to drop out because they're not getting A's anymore, and having this misconception that in science you need to have an A to go forward, and it's not true for anybody. And so having your support system that is able to maybe help you out when you're either feeling down or got a bad test score or whatever, is really invaluable. And the earlier you can get that like healthy support system, the better. Yeah, that would be my number one piece of advice.
I love it. So culturally, we do have this big challenge of sort of anti-science, you know, people that don't accept science is true, people that are science skeptical. And on top of that, you know, we have this big challenge. There, one of the things I notice in working in an education department is that there's often a science anxiety that's similar to math anxiety among early elementary teachers, right? I don't know how good I am at science. I'm worried about it. And so given the reality of sort of the science anxiety and that how contentious science has gotten, a lot of times science just gets pushed aside in the early years. And I'm curious, what do you think are the long-term effects of early elementary not having deep scientific learning happening?
I mean, I think it is a problem that we're seeing like play out broadly across society right now. The lack of science literacy has harmed us greatly. I think that one of the original sins of the United States education system is that we I think this was established back in the 1950s. We were we changed our system such that we wanted to make elite scientists over a broadly science literate population. And so in the process, we funneled our, like, you know, what we perceived as smart kids to the sciences and really ran them through a rigorous curriculum to get them to be elite scientists. But if you weren't on the science track, your science really got left behind. And that is a huge problem because it doesn't matter if you're going to be a scientist or not. You need science and you need those critical thinking skills to function well in society, whether you're deciding what to feed your kids at the grocery store, whether you're deciding how often or when to go to the doctor, when to get vaccinated, all this sort of stuff, or deciding, you know, what policies to, like, what candidates to vote for based on, let's say, climate science and climate legislation. This is all really important decisions that we're all making that involve science and that science literacy helps with. And so smaller scale, having teachers be intimidated by science and kind of stray away from it. I think that students really pick up on that. And so if your teacher at an early age is kind of giving you the sense that science is scary, that's not helping anything. Because science doesn't have to be scary. It's just that we've made it this, like, this academic challenge when it doesn't have to be. Like, you don't have to know about atomic physics to be a science literate person in 2021. And so kind of rethinking how we pitch science in education, I think is something I wish we would do. And I hope that we do.
Yeah. And one of the things I'm struck by is just how this type of interaction breaks down some of those walls, right? You know, I'm imagining a second grade classroom or seniors in high school, either one engaging in a conversation with scientists. And if it seems like that would be the beginning of breaking down some of the perceptions about science and scientists and the role of science in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, broadly, one of the things that Skype a Scientist is really trying to do is make science, like, friendly, fun, approachable, and, like, not a challenge to you. So we want to have these friendly, positive conversations. Even in other aspects of our program, we're trying to just have positive experiences with science. We're putting on shows when there's not a pandemic and we can actually do live shows. We try to gamify science the best we can. I even have this little side project called the Squid Mobile, which is my car. My car is covered in squid, and the back window says, "Want a squid fact? Text squid to this phone number, 1-833-SCI-TEXT. And it'll just send you squid facts. And so I want to make experiences with science just, like, fun and whimsical, and it's not going to be on an exam later. And so we're trying to think of ways to just, like, inject science into everyday life in non-threatening ways.
Okay. So I am really intrigued by the squid thing. What are some fascinating squid facts? I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but
that's why I'm what are some things facts,
that so. People who don't know about squid, because I got to say, like, not a lot of people love squid. Like, you're right. Everyone loves dolphins, right? I grew up with, like, the Trapper Keeper with the dolphin.
Yeah, with the Lisa Frank brightly colored. Yeah.
Right. But what are some things about squids that just fascinating facts? I'm really curious.
Okay, so I have some, like, off the cuff quick facts. Like, okay. The one thing that not a lot of people know is that squid have beaks for mouths. So in the center of those arms and tentacles, there's a beak in there. That's kind of, if you didn't already know that, that sometimes is a mind blower. But broadly speaking, like, why are squid cool? The answer is that they have diverged in evolution so long ago. The first squid existed before there were trees. So that is a really, really long time ago. It's, like, kind of hard to conceptualize Earth without trees, but there were cephalopods before there were trees. So cephalopods are octopus, cuttlefish, squid, and the nautilus. Mm-hmm. And so these invertebrates, so animals without backbones, are the most behaviorally complex of that group. And we are also pretty behaviorally complex. I mean, so are a lot of mammals. But I kind of think it's really interesting and fun to take a look at another animal living on our planet that is behaving so complexly, but so different from us. When they're communicating with each other, they're not using sound, they're using color change. So they're color changing constantly to communicate with one another. That's awesome. They
Just a second. When you say color change, their actual color is changing?
Exactly. So,
oh wow.
Okay. This is we could honestly.
No, this is really cool. No. This is going in the podcast. I am fascinated by this.
Okay, so the skin of cephalopods is really, really amazing because it's full of these little expanding and contracting balls of color called chromatophores, and they're able to control those at the speed of thought. So if they expand all of their red chromatophores, they look red, and if they expand all their yellow ones, they look yellow. And there are, in some species, 300 of these little structures per square inch. So this is like, you know, high definition skin that they're working with. So they're able to control the patterns on their bodies, the colors of their bodies. They're even able to do wacky things like make their bodies look like a hypnotist wheel. They make these little black bars and move them across their body in this wild hypnotic looking way to confuse prey, and sometimes to intimidate each other. And so they do a lot of really wild things with this ability. And some of it is to hide. So they're able to take a look at their surroundings, make themselves look like something that belongs there so predators can't see them. They're using it to communicate with each other. They're using it to confuse prey. They use it for a lot of things, just like we use our sound to talk and to sing, etc.
So, all right, last squid question. So you always hear about how smart an octopus is and how they problem solve and how they can do this and they can do that. Are there any things in terms of problem solving or behaviors? I know that this is tricky to say problem solving because that's sort of a human concept of the way I'm describing it, but are there any cool things that they do that you would say the average person thinks, well, a squid's obviously not very smart, therefore they can't do blank? What would you say to that? Are there any things that they do that would surprise people?
I think so. So cuttlefish are the ones that have had more of this sort of test done on them. So squid and cuttlefish are more closely related to one another than mm-hmm. they are to the octopus. They both have 10 limbs. They're both sort of more torpedo shaped than octopus shaped. I often kind of lump them together, even though cuttlefish tend to be the ones that are getting all the credit for being smart. They can solve a maze. And they can also, it was recently shown that they can win, I guess, at the marshmallow test. So this is a psychological experiment that was done in the 70s on kids that says, you know, you could eat one marshmallow now, but if you don't eat that marshmallow, you're going to get two marshmallows in a couple minutes. Can you navigate this situation to get the maximum marshmallow reward? And with cuttlefish, they did this slightly differently because cuttlefish aren't big fans of marshmallow, but they really, really like crabs and shrimp. And so they gave them like a decent snack, but if the cuttlefish waited, it would get an even better snack. And so they quickly learned that this was what was happening, and they would reject the bad snack if they knew that a better snack was coming. So that's the kind of complexity we're working with here. It's pretty impressive.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
I love it. Thanks so much for sharing that. So you talked a little bit before we got on about the fact that you do live streams and certain things like that. So do you want to just share for the audience, you know, again, first of all, how they can sign up for this? We want to emphasize it is free. But just what are some of the learning opportunities that you offer?
Yeah, so once a week we do a live stream with the scientists. It's a live stream with me, the scientist, and an ASL interpreter. They're totally free to sign up. You just go to skypeascientist.com and then click our events page, and Skype a Scientist Live is what we're talking about here. We do them once a week, typically at 1 p.m. Eastern. So everybody, at least in the continental United States, is in the classroom at that time. And you submit the questions. You don't have to be on a webcam. Actually, you can't be, because we like to keep it super safe for the kids. But you type questions that your students may have into the Q&A function of the webinar. And then I ask them out loud to the scientist. We can also get your classroom a shout out in the live stream if that's important to you. We're happy to do that. And these are all free. And you can check them out. Yeah, at skypeascientist.com. If you want to have your classroom matched with a scientist, that's also free. Go to skypeascientist.com, click Get Involved, and then you fill out a form. We match everybody up once a week. You typically get your matches on a Friday or over the weekend. And then it's up to you to email the scientist and pick a time to get the ball rolling. Yeah, our whole program is free and completely supported by small donations. Like, the average support is like $10 to support our program. We're small, and we try to keep it as free for everybody as we can.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing this. I love the work that you're doing. And for anyone listening, please check it out.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. So again, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever it is that you get your podcasts? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.